And my name is Damon, and I am an alcoholic. This is the book I had in treatment 12 years ago. You know, what it tells me to talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And actually, this guy remembers that a lot better than I do. I don't know anybody else, you know. They talk about it's hard to remember the pain and the suffering of even a week or a month ago. Take on 12 years, and that becomes a whole different beast. When I say I'm an alcoholic, for me what that means is alcohol is not my problem. Yeah, I tried many times to quit. And I'd quit for a while, and I'd feel pretty good about myself, and then I'd get a little bit restless. You know what it is, the little stuff. What you're looking at. You know, what do you think about it? You know, that little thing where the car, the traffic, they're coming in, it's like a pressure cooker. Kind of builds up after a while. And then I change my mind about not drinking. Anybody ever done that? You know, so all of a sudden I take a drink. And then, of course, the allergy kicks in. And that drink takes a drink. I remember going to see Marcel Marceau. Anybody ever heard of him? The French painter. And he was down at the Atlanta Civic Center. And this is way back 60s, I guess, early 70s. And he was walking along, and he runs into this box. And then the box starts getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And all of a sudden, he's enclosed in it on the ground. And he reaches up, and he pulls the box over his head, brushes himself off, and he starts walking along, and he hits the box. You know? And that was so much what it was like. I was... I've gotten involved in a lot of service work, and all but one of the things I do in service, I started out reluctantly. Sometimes no, sometimes hell no, you know. And each one of them has turned out to be a remarkable experience. The one, though, that I did not resist, in fact, I sought out, was to go into the jail meetings. And I don't know if you've been around anybody that's done jail meetings before. There's a crazy passion about these folks. We go down to Macon, and we're down there and doing some of the workshops, and the last one at 9:30 on Saturday, and they have to come knock on a door sometimes to get us out from this work. But I was over at a work release meeting at Cobb County's finest gated community, and there was a guy there, and he says, yeah, he says, when I get out, I'm going to quit drinking and using. And I said, for God's sake, don't quit. And he said, it's just something that came to me. And because it doesn't even say quit in our book. You know, if I was going to write a book on not drinking, one of the things I'd say is quit drinking. First step, quit drinking. Bill doesn't say that. Isn't that amazing that he doesn't say quit drinking? What he does say is we have a design for living. And the idea is not to quit, but rather to start. To start being the husband that my wife married. You know, to start being the father that God would intend me to be. To start being that. And what happens is when I look down at the list of things about being a good father, I see that not, you know, drinking's not on the list. If I look at the things about being a good husband, for damn sure, drinking is not on the list. There's a big difference between it not being on the list of my design for living and quitting. And I'll give you an analogy of that. I heard about the little hunters, the bushmen of the Kalahari, and the way they hunt the gazelle. Now, the gazelle has no sweat glands. And so the only way it can get rid of heat is through its mouth. But it's very fast. Now, as humans, we stand upright, we have sweat glands, we can get rid of that heat, and we are built for long-distance running. And so what they do is they get together and they get that gazelle running and running and running. They pick one out of the herd, they get it running and running, until finally the gazelle passes out standing up. And they walk over with a little pointed wooden stick, stab it right in the heart. You see, if I'm running from my disease, I'm the gazelle. But in How It Works, we read it all the time. What does it say? God could and would if he were sought. So when I become a hunter, rather than somebody running from my disease, I'm built for long-distance hunting. And I find out that that's really the so much about this complete psychic change. There's so many different elements to this complete psychic change. Now, some of you might wonder whether I drank at all based on what I'm talking about, so maybe I should cover a little bit of that. I remember one of the talks I listened to was, I thought it was going to be a great talk. It was the first talk from the first Georgia State Convention. And it was just, you know, from 1950 or 51. By the end of the talk, I said, did you actually drink? You know, it was just a lot of advice about staying sober. So I realized the power of that identification, what it really means. I was born in Atlanta in 1955, Georgia Baptist Hospital. Two older sisters, mother and father. Got absolutely no excuse for drinking the way I drank. And what's beautiful about this program is we don't need to ask why. Everybody in this room drank for a different reason. You know? I think we can leave that to the psychiatrist and everything who wants to kind of look at that. In fact, Dr. Bob said, you know, we don't need to deal with Freudian complexes and other things that are interesting to the scientific mind that have really very little to do with our real AA work, which is, and that boils down to love and service. So to me, what this program about is not about not understanding why I drank the way I did, but what I need to do is know how to live successfully. And I've learned that by watching other people do that successfully. I bet you the Bushmen of the Kalahari didn't learn how to hunt the gazelle by reading a textbook. They probably watched somebody else and were there and participated in it and failed a few times, and they learned how to do it that way. So I was a guy who, from a very early age, got pleasure by sneaking around. Anybody else? Pleasure by sneaking around, yeah. We had a pull-your-pants-down club with a girl down the street when I was 6 years old, and we were the only two members. So played a lot. That comes back later on in the story. But, you know, I was always one of those. But, you know, we moved up to Marietta from East Point in 1964. And I know today they give the kids Ritalin, you know, when they're back then they gave us Paddling. Did anybody else get that? And anyway, I got the Paddling a couple of times, and my mom decided to take me to a child psychologist. And the message back from him was, he's bored. So my parents didn't really have, you know, my dad was a traveling salesman. He wasn't, you know, super well off, but they did a lot of sacrifices in order to send me to a private school down at Pace Academy down on West Paces Ferry Road. And that was from about fourth or fifth grade, I guess, on, fifth grade on. And, but I was the outsider in that school. And I think how many times I've listened to all of these different CDs about that feeling of not being connected, about not being there. But what was curious about that, in the neighborhood I lived in Marietta, I was one of the first houses there. And so I was the ringleader there. So it also talks about, in page 73, when it talks about the alcoholic leads a double life. I really had one. You know, I was a ringleader there. We had a three-story tree hut, three sections, top floor. By the way, we had a built-in spinner in there for spin the bottle. I don't recall ever using it for that, but we were hopeful, you know. But and of course, I was my sister's favorite story about that is when I first put it in, I found a very convenient flooring called drywall. And as I was on the third floor, my sister said she was washing the dishes and heard this, ah, ah. And I went through three layers of floor to. So, you know, I wasn't always the sharpest one on the block when it came. But, you know, okay, good lesson, you know. Now, don't use drywall on the floor. Okay, got that. That says a lot for most of the way I learn things, you know, is by, crunch, crunch. Okay. And it, you know, takes more than one floor generally for me to pick up on it. But I was also one of those, had anybody else been told you had a lot of potential if you only applied yourself? Ooh, I hear a lot of groans out there. Yeah. So I was in the school, but, you know, it was kind of during the 60s, you know, and I sniffed glue when I was 8. My sister turned me on to marijuana when I was 10 as a step up. And then we got drunk for the first time at 12 years old. We put the clear stuff in the Sprite bottle. We put the color stuff in the Coke bottle. Went out, and we drank it all so we wouldn't get in trouble. Of course, we all got sick. You know, but that my sister came home and found us, and she just said we had the flu, you know. So the next day I got off from school, you know, no real negative consequences. And that was kind of the way. But during that time, it was all really more experimental at that point. It was what other people were doing. I was down with the hippies down in Piedmont Park, I mean, making candles and selling joints while they're playing in the park. And it was an interesting time. One of those hippies, David Perkins, asked me when I was 15, he said, is it a coincidence you're a Christian in a Christian country? If it's the truth of the universe, why does it matter where you're born? Well, that was interesting. If I was born in Saudi Arabia, probably be Islam. If I was born in India, I might be Hindu or Sikh or Muslim or, you know, Buddhist or, you know, and it was this idea, if I'm really seeking truth, you know, what is truth? And I think, you know, in a lot of ways, those of us who come into AA and we stay in AA are those who are seekers. You know, we've always been seekers. We've been looking for something, you know, throughout our lives. The ones who come and seem to stay. It's sort of the program's uniquely suited for us. But I was sitting on top of Kennesaw Mountain, and I was trying to imagine the curve of the earth. And you can't see it from there. And I thought, boy, this is a big place. You know? So even then, I had something today that's at the heart and in the very center of my sobriety, and that is wonder and awe. Wonder and awe. I like this little Indian yogi I read. He said, to know reality, you must be astonished. You know, what an amazing experience this is. But you know, what happened for me is my parents ran away from home when I was 17 and moved to Alabama. They always wanted to live on the lake. They asked me to come down with them, but I'm going like a town of 2,000, and I used to hitchhike down to Atlanta. So I moved down to 12th Street between Peachtree and West Peachtree, had a job there at a Blue Cross Blue Shield in their mail room, and best title I ever had, I was chief inserter. Goes back to the pull your pants down club, I guess. But anyway, it was running a Phillipsburg six-station inserting machine that stuffed mail into envelopes, and you know, and I was a hard worker at that. In fact, I got that job because I did a lot of shredding for them, and I just shredded a lot of documents for them faster than they. So I was given good work ethics. You know, my parents were from the Depression era. You know, and I was taught those things about doing a good job. Well, anyway, sometime around in there, I really quit smoking weed and all of that, you know. And when I did, the circle disappeared except for just a couple people. And I decided there that maybe those guys that had the college education, I could use a college education. And really made my own, you know, the decision. I became willing to apply myself. And I went down and lived with my parents. They were living on a lake. They traveled 2 or 3 weeks at a time. And I got to have the place essentially to myself. We had a boat, you know, and I was going to school there, and people were living around the lake. It was a marvelous time. You know, we could either drive or we could, the boat or the car, to go from place to place. Just some great times. You know? Did anybody here never have any fun drinking? Because that would be a really sad story. You know, to wind up in AA here, you know, and I had some great times, you know, and some good, fond memories. And in fact, I did very well there. My parents pretty much said you can go anywhere you like to go to school, and I wanted for higher education. And I saw that the mountains in Colorado were the highest concentration of 14,000 foot peaks in the continental United States. So I called up long distance operator back then. You know, you could do that and ask, "What colleges do you have in Colorado?" And she said, "Well, Colorado and Colorado State." And I said, "No, hold on." And I pulled a penny out of my pocket and I flipped the coin. And it was tails, and so I went to Colorado State. So that was my planning for higher education. So sometimes that turns out to be some of the best planning I could possibly do. I wound up that first week, it was during the summer, and we came down, they were handing out refrigerators, you know, to the different people there. And I sat down on a couch, and there's these two gals there talking, and I butted in the conversation. Those who know me find that really hard to believe. But anyway, that was Sarah, and this October we'll have been married 37 years. So I like the guy who said we never decided to divorce each other at the same time. So, and but I feel really blessed that way. She is kind of neat. She had she was taking welding, woodworking, and anatomy as part of the occupational therapy. So she had burn holes in her jeans from the welding. She had stains on her fingers from making this great backgammon board she made. And then she smelled of formaldehyde because they were dissecting a corpse. You know, this is an interesting lady. You know, I'm gonna. So anyway, and I was taking Chinese history and philosophy and Indian history. I took a year of Chinese language. I was just trying to look around the other side of the world and trying to that whole kind of seeking for truth. And I mean, we drank some. It was that during that time, but it wasn't where I was dependent upon alcohol at any time. And one of the things I did that was very significant is that I did, while she was doing her residency in Baylor, instead of finishing up my degree there, I took a year off, and I was working as an orderly in a nursing home. And you talk about finding truth. To be around people who are looking back on 94 years of life, 100 years of life, I learned something that I still hold on to this day, and it's not what I do, it's how I do what I do that becomes the most important. And I would see that's something I learned then. And that really carried me forward because we got married, we moved back to Atlanta. I wound up going to finishing up at Georgia State. And actually, I took two computer courses, one Fortran and one Basic. And they went to get my graduation for my undergraduate degree in history. And they said, "We got a problem." I said, "What's that?" I said, "Well, we can't test you in Chinese." I didn't say anything. It had been 2.5 years since I had Chinese. So I was like, what I said was, "Oh, yes, you do have a problem." And they said, "Oh, wait a minute, you've had Fortran." I said, "That's a computer language." He said, "Yeah, but it's spoken all over the world." So my undergraduate degree is in history, especially in India and China, and my foreign language is Fortran. Which turned out well because as I began to take those courses, it turned out that my history degree was very well suited to computer programming. Because really all computer programming is the history of data flowing through a system. And it's impacted by different forces the same way, you know, trends in history are. And for some reason that, and the fact I've been around guitars and amplifiers and stuff and the wiring and how to hook stuff up, it became a very natural thing for me to do. So on my resume, I guess I could say that I'm capable of conversing with inanimate objects. So. And that has also turned out to serve me very well in AA. Because there was something that I could give to a lot of different people and get a chance to meet a lot of different people and go to their homes. And some of my mentors and some of those people I kind of put up on a pedestal, and I saw how they behaved with their wife sometimes, and I realized we all got the same amount of sobriety here, man. We all do. You know, it's the quality of my sobriety at this moment. I was with two gentlemen. One of my mentors, he died with 54 years in the program. He got sober with Sister Ignatia in Cleveland in Rosary Hall. And he was a news broadcaster, Jim Doney. And so everybody knew he drank because he described it this way. Imagine trying to drink just enough so your hands don't shake on TV camera, but not too much so you slur your words. He said, "You try and hit that mark every day, you know, of the week." So... But anyway, he had just over 48 years. Anybody remember Bill Roop here? And Bill was sitting there with us at the old-timers meeting, and Bill had just under 52 at the time. And we were comparing notes, and it was almost to the day 100 years together. And I've seen both of them in their off moments, and they've seen me in my off moments. You know, what I've come to believe is becoming is very unbecoming. You know, this idea of becoming something when I reach this number of years, of becoming this, and I spend all my... Have you ever met anybody who spent all their time becoming? Sorry, why don't we just stop and be? You know, just get a chance to be. You know, I like to think of myself as in a constant state of arrival. You know, hey, I just got here. Hey, I just got here again. Hey, I just got here again. You know? And there's not, because there isn't... You know what I found out as an old history major? There's no back there. There is no back there. I used to think there was a back there. What I realized, if it's not now, it's not real. Is that a true statement? If it's not now, it's not real. So what's now about the past? Well, if my wife is thinking about my past right now, or my daughter or my son or somebody I sponsor or somebody I met, somebody I gave a CD to, somebody's thinking, that collective consciousness is my past. And it's now. The past is now. And you know what? It's changing based on how I'm treating you right now. And not only directly, because this thing, this power greater than ourselves that we're connected to is not local. It's somehow non-local, meaning I don't have to be in the room to have the effect happen. Something magic. And let me tell you what's amazing. When all that searching around and I did for seeking for truth, I never found God in the readings. I never found God in my thoughts. I never found God in my understanding. So I assumed there was no God. Sorry. You know? But and I'll talk a little bit about that as when I came in and the change that's happened since then. Today I call myself a retired atheist. It got to be way too much work to describe what was going on and explain away. And I got too old for it. So it's a good time when something gets too much work and you get too old for it, great time to retire, right? So I get a job with Equifax because I get hired on. I didn't have to really do a resume on that point. One of the professors recommended me. And I spent 12 years with them. And those were years I did not drink alcoholically during the 80s. I did not. My son was born in 1984. My daughter was born in 1989. But somewhere along in there, William James, who wrote The Varieties of Religious Experience, which actually was a 7-part lecture that he did, in which Bill Wilson was reading on that week he was in Towns Hospital, the week of December 12th of 1934. He read this. And William James, the father of American psychology, was talking about what's the nature, from a psychiatrist standpoint, not about the dogma or anything having to do with that, but just what's it like for, what was the common experience that people had who had a spiritual experience. Now, if you go to read it, just remember that this book starts off like an old car in winter, okay? Because he's going to spend a lot of time talking about what he's not going to talk about. But then when he gets into it, there's some real jewels of experience in there because he starts outlining different experiences. But the beautiful, one of the things he said, there's two things. First of all, we don't find God in the mountaintops. We find God in the valleys. You know, when we're in trouble, when we're in pain, when we're tired, you know, all of a sudden my ego kind of gives up and a space is created in between my thoughts where something is there. Something begins to shine outward from me is what my experience has been. So what happened, the other commonality was people who go through a spiritual experience have a shift from pessimism to optimism. What I had was a shift from optimism to pessimism. I started looking at what was wrong with that wife. Okay? She, and all of this stuff, so she had a lot of clutter in the house. A lot of clutter. I didn't have hallways. I had little aisleways between boxes, you know. And all of this clutter and stuff. Well, since I've gotten sober, my sponsor, when I met, I was complaining about my wife. He said, hold on. He said, how long did you drink alcoholic? And I didn't understand the importance of the question, but I'll go ahead and answer it. I said, about 10 years. He said, give her 10 years. I said, well, I mean, that's fair, but don't you think it's a little extreme? Don't I get like 2 for 1 or something, you know? And so I started, what I had to do is the other thing I've learned in this program, which has been one of the greatest tools I have, and what the 4th step teaches us and 5th step teaches us and the 8th, and that is called change the story. See, what I need to do is change the story I'm telling myself about what's going on such that it adds to the quality of the lives of the people around me. One of the things I found out in my search for truth is that my opinions are not facts. All of my facts are opinions, except one. I am. I like this old Chinese monk. He woke up one morning, he dreamed he was a butterfly, and he asked himself, well, how do I know I'm not a butterfly dreaming I'm a monk? And it becomes astonishingly difficult to answer that. It really does. I mean, and where is it? And Clancy, who's one of the great speakers, you know, he's the most recorded speaker in AA, definitely. But he talks about this thing as a disease of perception. You see, the truth really is, I think we together know the truth a lot more than I know the truth. Collectively, this room knows a lot more truth than I know. And that's the beauty of this thing, that it's a collective, and it's the collective set of perceptions, and we find out what works. You know, ultimately, what works? What is it that creates a quality of life? You see, I didn't want the car. I wanted the way I thought it was going to feel when I got the car. I didn't want the house. I wanted the way I thought I was going to feel when I got the house. And that pessimism was coming from the fact that I had this expectation, but I wasn't feeling that way. You know, and it wasn't enough. And, you know, this disease is the disease of not enough. It talks about it in 60 to 63, the actor wanting to run the whole, he's wanting to get his arrangements. I want to arrange my circumstances so that then it will change the way I feel. Rather than changing the inner story I'm telling myself, changes everything that's important about every situation I'm in. One of the guys said about this opinions and facts, he said, okay, it's raining. I said, yeah, but is it good rain or bad rain? You know? What's my attitude towards the rain? It's not just whether it's raining or not, but what's my attitude towards it? And so much of AA is attitude adjustment in it. A way of changing the story. What is the fourth step? Change the story. What's the third step? Change the story. What's the first step? Change the story. I just saw I got a breakthrough with one of the guys I've been sponsoring. And he finally admitted he could be insane. I just used that word. And Bill says it great. He says we were strangely insane. We have a unique form of insanity, you know, which I think if I ever separate out from you guys and separate away, I'm a dead duck for that stuff. I'm right back in it. See, I don't stay sober. We stay sober. What I do is whatever I can to connect up with you. Those giving away of the CDs helps me connect up with people. You see this cross sitting here? You see, in order for me to get connected with God, I need to be connected with you. Left and right. And the joining of the two. I can't have one without the other. God is everything or He's nothing. If He's everything, then you're part of that. So me connecting with you helps me to connect with God. And why, that's why we got to get rid of resentments. I got to get rid of that. You know, that sex inventory really is manipulation of other people as a means to an end. That, you know, the whole, I might get all this stuff, but what I'm going to wind up with is the booby prize because I won't get unity. In the 12 traditions, the first tradition is the goal, unity. Remember about being an alcoholic in our cups is the loneliest creature on earth. It's about getting connected. And how do I get connected? I change the story. So I went from being an optimist to a pessimist. And I went to one of my employees had a bachelor party, and we went to this belly dancing thing, and then they were going to a strip joint afterwards. And I thought, you know, not much difference there. And I went over. No, this was a pull-your-pants-down club with a, you know, grown-up style, you know. And I'm thinking, I'm not getting this at home, you know. So several weeks later, I had worked late at night on some program. And I said, well, I need to go. Maybe I've got a massage, maybe, you know. I went and stopped, and this lady offered me the full treatment. And I accepted it. Now, I justified it by saying, oh, in China and Japan, they have concubines. You know, and, you know, kind of a woman the wife knows about, you know. Well, this is delusion because I'm not in China or Japan. My wife's not Chinese or Japanese. So rationalization and justification, anybody familiar with that? You know, that's pleasure by sneaking around. But I'll tell you what it is because Mama raised me better than that. One of the things I'm very, very grateful for today is my ability to feel guilty. And that reading we did for the daily reflections, he was talking about shame and guilt. Those are two very different things. Shame says God made a mistake when He made me. Okay, which can't be correct. That's me saying God made it. I don't think that's probably accurate. Each and every one of you is perfectly you at this moment. There's nobody more perfectly you at this moment than you are at this moment. You know, this moment is perfectly this moment. For me to say otherwise, it's say, for me to say, God, you made a mistake. I knew better how this moment should have been created. I know better how that person should be behaving. I know better. So today I can say, this moment is perfectly this moment. And one of the things that's perfect about this moment is that there's room for improvement. If there was no room for improvement, we would have no jobs. Right? We wouldn't have anything to do. One of the things that's perfect about it is that there's room for improvement. So what happened was I had this sense of guilt, which is, I was, you know, which kind of turned to shame, you know, after a time. But it's really that sense of, and it goes back to the to this concept of sin. Is anybody familiar with the Greek, that this is a Greek term from archery? And what they did, literally, archery is from they were arching the arrows to, in order to hit people on top of the head who were marching at them in a field getting ready to try and kill them. So it's a good idea to practice to see if you can actually hit something, you know, because it's life or death. So what they do to practice is they put a circle out in a field and they'd shoot at the circle, and the distance from the middle of the circle was the sin. So it means to miss the mark. Now, I was beginning to move the circle around, expand, you know what I'm saying? Because to fit my behavior, rather than a universally accepted group of principles, which we have in this program. And then I can recenter my target as being that's what I'm aiming for, rather than me making my own target, saying that, okay, it's concubines. That just changes the whole target. But I couldn't live with that. There was a disconnectedness happening here because I was not connecting here. So, you know, I started when I go out of town sometimes, I'd, you know, call it escort service or something like that. Again, just more and more disconnected. And now all of a sudden I'm crossing the line in terms of the drinking. I remember in the morning, I remember the day it happened, driving into work, having the shakes, getting ready. I was going to have to do a tour of a big data center. By now I'm working for HP. Got millions of dollars of equipment designed out these data centers, doing all this stuff. And I got the shakes, just like my friend Jim Doney, you know. And I had to drink enough not to have the shakes. Well, in April of 2001, I was put on probation because somebody smelled my breath. I was drinking vodka. They shouldn't be able to smell my breath. Yeah, right. Anyway, that's an old wives' tale, you know, but anyway, and I denied it, but you know what else I did is I quit drinking. Again, that thing, and we've done that before, and I put on the afterburners, you know, and I started working, I started getting accolades, and I see some nods. We've done that, haven't we? Get into the trouble, put it on, man. We can really show them, don't you? You know, and then I get all the way up into August, and a past presidential candidate fired us. This Carly, you know, he laid off everybody who was on probation, which really was a good move in my case. Because I lasted till September 11 when I saw the planes fly into the towers. I was over in Birmingham at my sister's house, and I knew my whole industry had changed. And there came the pessimism in. And I lasted 3 more days, and my sister and brother-in-law went out for a German club, and I didn't want to go because they were going to have drinking, but you know, I knew where their blackjack was. Don't we always know? We know where the supply is, right? And I was going to have one drink. I didn't know about the allergy thing. And I had 3. Now, I also get pleasure by sneaking around, so I wasn't going to drink the whole bottle. But that next morning, I'm up at 9 o'clock in the parking lot of a liquor store. And it doesn't open until 9:30. You know what I did, right? I waited. If I stay here with you guys, I will never, ever have to be that guy sitting in that liquor store parking lot waiting for my medicine. Who was in charge? King Alcohol. That quick, too. One night of drinking and I'm back out to it. I started a series of those ups and downs until Thanksgiving of 2003. I had been quit for 3 months. I'm over back in Birmingham, got my family. We're all getting along great. I go and the compulsion hits. For no other reason, I went and got $300 out of the bank we could not afford, And I told my family I had some client thing going on, didn't have any clients, but I lied about it going over there. And I'm driving from Birmingham to Atlanta going, don't think about what you're doing. Don't think about it. La, 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 la. I went to a Mardi Gras thing and went over to a massage parlor over there. 3-4 days later, I had 105 degree temperature. And I was sure that I had caught some sort of sexually transmitted disease. And it broke, but at the same time, I began passing gas and debris when I urinated. Something, you know, I don't know, alcohol tears up the body. Alcohol is not a mild drug. It affects more organs in the body than any other drug that we know about. The pancreas, the heart, the liver, the lungs, you know, every aspect of it. So this is December, and I just got hopeful. I waited to see if it would go away, and in February I finally went to the doctor. Now, he gave me some sort of swab test thing, but I wouldn't pee into the cup. Because I don't want them to take my solution away. Remember, alcohol is my solution. If they find out I had to drink just to get over there, to drive over there, then they may take my solution away. But I found out, well, it wasn't a sexually transmitted disease, you know. And I lasted again until May, and my wife said, you got to go find out whatever's wrong with you. I was drinking a fifth of vodka a day, and she really didn't know it. I was smoking cigarettes for 8 to 10 years. She didn't know it. I would be hanging out the bathroom window smoking. Just like I did when I was sneaking out back in that neighborhood where we had the tree hut and all that. You know, they have a great question for an alcoholic. What would a grown-up do? You know, here I was acting like I was back in the old neighborhood. And I'm 40 years old, you know, 25 years married. So it came, my wife gave me one of those ultimatum letters in July. And basically, I don't know what's wrong with you, but we may lose the house. If we do, you know, I'll get another one. You may not be invited, you know. So on August the 9th of 2004, I'd had my last bit of vodka. It was a Monday morning. And my Barton vodka. And by the way, in the middle of the 1990s, I got a DUI down in downtown Atlanta with a fifth of Courvoisier. I had a half a fifth in me and a half a fifth under the seat. And I wound up spending the night in jail. And you know what? I swore I'd not do that ever. I was embarrassed. I was crying tears, doing all this. My wife having to come down and bail me out. That lasted 6 months before I changed my mind about not drinking. But I was back, though, to the old plan. On the 9th and the 10th, the 10th is my sobriety date, but I was to the old plan, which was Damon quits on his own. Well, at 3 o'clock in the morning on August the 12th of 2004, I'd had my 1 hour sleep. I woke up and I said the three-word prayer of an atheist, and I said, I need help. And I set it down to the very depths of my inner being. And something happened. I look back and I have not had the obsession to drink since that time. I'm absolutely certain that would not have lasted. But I'll tell you this, what I got tired of is I got tired of the spinning plates. This lie to my wife and that lie. Because I'd lied to her about going to behavioral services. And here it was, the day. And I'm tired of lying. And I said, well, what do I stop lying about? And I had to say everything. By the way, this is not in the book, folks. This is not by the book. But I don't know nothing by the book, except I looked at AA online. It had God in it, and I said, that can't be for me. So I woke her up. She's sleeping on the couch. She's not sleeping in the room with me, you know. And she's drinking some to keep her, to get herself to sleep. Get my daughter off to school. I tell her I've been, and I just said it this way, I've been a son of a bitch. That's the quote. And I basically outlined what I've been doing, except the smoking. Her dad's a cancer surgeon, and she just hated smoking. But the next Tuesday, I told her about it. But that day, I quit. That was the last. I have not had a cigarette since then. Because it's all a lie. I got tired of lying. Here I was, a truth seeker who had become a habitual liar about everything. exactly the opposite of what I wanted to become. And I called up behavioral services, and they said, well, we can get you in August 31st. I said, I don't think you understand. I've been drinking a fifth of vodka a day, and I'm ready. They said, we'll call you back. So meanwhile, I made my doctor's appointment to check out what somebody called the tuba thing. And I wound up getting my appointment on the next Tuesday. I made a list, and here is a list I made during that weekend of all of the things that I needed to do. And I was just looking at it right before here, you know, update my resume, research Alcoholics Anonymous. It was one of the things, I research it, find out if you guys, you know, had a good plan. I look back, there's a few of these I still haven't finished up, so maybe I should go back to this list. I showed it to my wife, and she said, certainly is a long list, isn't it, though? All the things we neglect as a result of this alcoholism. This isn't about alcohol. This is alcoholism. It's a big difference. If alcohol is my problem, just quit drinking. If I've got the ism, I've got the thing that's the restless, irritable, and discontent piece. I have to change the story. I have to have a complete psychic change. So I went to behavioral services, and they gave me the little syllabus, and on there was go to AA. I said, fine, okay, fine. Ryan, I've been, okay, that's a way to research it. It's on my list. Okay. It was 12 years ago today that I went to my first AA meeting. And the night before, I'd had my first full night's sleep. You know, I think I'd also had my first really solid bowel movement. Anybody else? That should be in the promises. So. You know, I mean, really, it tears up the body. I mean, I was not doing well. But I was able to share with this gal in only, was it like 2 days, that I had slept that night. I didn't tell her about the bowel movement for them. Anyway. But what happened I came to my first meeting I found in AA in Cobb County. I tried to find three. And the third one was the one I finally found. And I was like, damn, you guys are anonymous. There's no kidding. I got my my big book down here. I bought it Borders. They're not even around anymore. The book's still around. It's got the little retail sticker on. Paid $12.99 because I couldn't find a meeting to buy a book in. But anyway, this guy there raised his hand to the right and kind of made some sense. And on my syllabus was get a sponsor, and they'd say in the local area. So the first meeting, by the way, I went to was 8111 down there. That's where I picked up my white chip because it was right around the behavioral services for Kaiser that was there. But anyway, this guy hauled dirt for a living, Steve Davis. And I built data centers out. And he took me out in the parking lot. Said, you believe in God? I said, no, don't think so. He said, how about a power greater than yourself? I said, no, I don't think so. He said, let me get this straight. You're the most powerful thing in the universe? I had to think about that for a second. I said, well, I guess not, he said. You know, maybe there's some hope for you, you know? And he said to me, I know only one way to do this, and that's by the book. Thank God. By the book. The way Edgar showed him how to do it. And on my fourth step, I burned it at the Howe place on New Year's Eve as part of the fireworks display with Happy Michael. We were out there burning that thing. November of 2005, I've actually got somebody to ask me to sponsor him. Just talked to him today. I was helping him out still today. So, he's about in the same shape when I met him the first time. So that's very interesting, you know. It teaches me a lot. But anyway, but he calls me up and he says, Damon, he says, I'm having a heart attack. I said, don't worry about coming down. I got an ambulance coming down. And don't worry about coming. The family's coming down to the hospital. But he said, you know that guy you're helping out there? You know, maybe you should talk to him about this and this. And I'm like, this guy's on the ball, you know. There he is, got an ambulance kind of picking him up, and he's thinking about another alcoholic. Anyway, I told my son, about this. My son just happened to be in the house there. He was living in an apartment. He goes back to his apartment, and his roommate comes out and says, my dad just had a heart attack. What's his name? Steve Davis. My son and his son were roommates. They weren't like acquaintances. We did not know this. This is where I start retiring as an atheist. There are rules beyond my reason. There's things happening I can't explain. Steve died on December 16th of 2005. I remember driving down Kellogg Creek Road over there and saying, I lost my sponsor. His voice came into my head and said, oh, I get it. It's all about you. Goodness. I thought you were dead. Okay. So I call up his sister. It turns out I've got a message on my phone from him about that, talking about working with the other alcoholic that I had saved on my phone. I was able to share that with the family. Well, and say a couple of the things related to service. And I'm going to do this a little bit. I'm going to try a little experiment. Never done this before. But I'm going to turn to the very last page, or next to the last page in the big book. And I'm going to talk about service as it relates to the warranties. Is anybody here familiar with the warranties? Okay, the warranties are contained in concept 12 on the last page of the big book. And these are actually part of the Articles of Incorporation for the organization that is the General Service Board and the World Services, Inc. So they would take 3/4 of all of the AA members to change these. And I'm going to tell you how they, and some of the ways these things have impacted me and what I've learned and a little bit about how I've learned it through service. It says, the conference shall observe the spirit of AA traditions, taking care that it never become the seat of perilous wealth or power. And I talk about living these in my own life. I take care of the family finances. I do not use those as a source of forcing someone in my family to do what I want them to do. I am a caretaker of those finances. I'm supposed to be there and to take care of them and to watch over them. Okay? So I can take that and live that in my life. And it says that sufficient operating funds in reserve be its prudent financial principle. And this is the idea, I don't need to accumulate too much. See, it's not more stuff. You know, Eric Clapton is in the program, and he said acquisition is not where it's at. Now, that guy could know, couldn't he? You know, acquisition is not where it's at. So I'm not measured by the amount of stuff I have. It's how I work with whatever God has given me to work with. And that it says in here that we don't ever put its members in a position of unqualified authority over others. Now, that's one of the beautiful things about this organization. When I first came in, the first meeting I went to, I saw the traditions on the wall, and I realized they had removed every possible objection that I had about belonging to AA. This is an incredible organization. I've been involved in marketing research. We were doing 20 or 30 companies at a time. Then I was with HP, and we were outsourcing. So we were involved in a lot of different organizations. I've seen a lot of different. There's nothing like this. This is absolutely unique in the world. It says that we reach all important decisions by discussion vote and whenever possible by substantial unanimity. I don't seek to have my will imposed on what my wife. I look in the family and say, how can we get substantial unanimity? Isn't that a great thing? I like it because that makes AA move slowly. And I don't need to rush. And if I can get substantial unanimity, because ultimately, again, I don't want the stuff. I want the way I think I'm going to feel. I want the quality of life I'm going to have. A substantial unanimity in a family is a fantastic to have that and to act upon that. That its actions never be personally punitive. Ooh, you know, that son of a gun wronged me. I have the right to Ann Smith, Dr. Bob's wife, said one of the things she wanted we need to surrender is our rights. Oh, and I said, this is America. What are you talking about? How about my right to be upset? My right to have you treat me a certain way? What if I can surrender that right and just focus on how I'm treating you instead of how you need to be treating me? Nor it needs to be any incitement to public controversy. I don't need to get into that. It never perform acts of government. I do not need to do any acts of government in my family. And I can also do that with the people I'm around, to not do acts of government, because that means a police, squad we'd have to have. And that's beautiful about AA. We don't perform acts of government. That like the society it serves, it will always remain democratic in thought and action. How I've gotten connected and how I've seen this work is at the state level. I'll tell you one story. The We Joy, let me just tell you real quickly about this. It started with a resentment. A lawyer I was doing computer work for when I first came in had gone to Dallas, Texas, flown down there, stayed in the hotel, brought back one CD. Now, in business law, my master's degree, I had done a paper on copyright infringement because I wanted to know how to do it and not get caught, because I was copying all kinds of computer software. And, so I knew what copyright law was, and he was asking me to copy these CDs. And they obviously looked like they were printed, from a professional. And also I thought, cheap, The guy's got a big house. He brings back one CD. And he also doesn't want me to show him how to do it, He wants me to do it for him. Well, the speaker was Ed Mutum. If anybody's heard Ed Mutum, Ed's story of forgiveness made the national news, and it was powerful. And I thought, I wonder if there's any more like this. And then Santa Claus brought me two tapes. The guy's John Cornelius, a professional Santa Claus, and he brought me these tapes. Say, can you convert these over to CD? And I went, I'm capable of conversing with inanimate objects. I guess I can. But it was a little reluctant. I was sort of like, okay, Well, once I learned how to do it, and his story is fantastic. He's this professional Santa Claus. He's sitting up north at this mall, and this lady sits on his lap. And he said, what can I get for you, the young lady? And she says, hi, Daddy. Turned out to be a daughter that he was told never to get near. And he had given up hope of even connecting up, and he was able to do. Well, once people found out I could take the stuff off cassettes, all of a sudden all the stuff coming out of the closet, because everybody's going from cassettes over to CDs, and all of a sudden I'm getting Joe and Charlie. I'm getting Bill Wilson. I'm getting Dr. Bob. I'm getting Clancy. I'm getting Sandy Beach. I'm getting all of these people I consider my mentors today. And I'm making out like a bandit, because then, in terms of giving them away, I thought, if I charge for them, then, okay, people are going to question, am I really making any money off of it? And I said, I don't want to. And so what I did is I just started giving them away, and then people started bringing me blanks. One guy brought me 900 blanks. But there's also the gal who brought me 15. I treasure them both, because that's all she had was 15. To be able to do it and give it away without expectation of anything in return, except I get the connectedness. I get the joining. So it got to be where it's people were going stuff online. So I began to develop the WeJoy website and to be able to begin to put stuff up there. We're now up to 1,300. And I decided, because I saw these other sites, but they didn't tell me anything about it. And I remember people by their stories. So I put a synopsis on each one of them. So I can look up the synopsis of, oh, yeah, that's that person. So I can remember who it is. Takes more time, but it's been, it's one of those acts of love for him. The other thing that's happened is in AA in Georgia, because I was GSR, I went down and I know something about websites and went to the web committee, and I saw the way that AA Georgia had its meetings. And the way they had it was almost like a calendar. Well, I know computers and search engines will look at that and go nuts. They will not be able to find any meetings based on that format. And I said, somebody needs to do something about it. 3 months later, I come back, still the same way. And I told him, the kind of person you need to do something about this would have this kind of talent. Come back 3 months later. I could really build you a prototype of this, okay? And then somebody can enter the data. So I build a prototype, come back. Okay, here it is. 3 months later, no data has been entered. Fine. Okay. So I start, and I wind up typing in every meeting in the state of Georgia. I just touched everybody in the state of Georgia that has an AA, you know, it has a GSO number. Not all the meetings, but all the, you know, all the groups. And as a result, I got to test the application we were using for maintaining and updating it. And what we did is we made it so we just output that format. Okay, so people didn't even know that it had changed. And then recently for the international, we rolled it out. So you have now find.aageorgia.org, and it's tied in with a Google map. And when you go in and you type in your zip code, you can see mapped out on the Google map all of your different sites. That was very reluctant. But I went ahead, and I don't know what gives me the willingness to do this. I go down to those jail meetings and I see these guys, and they're not willing to get to an AA meeting when they get out of the door. What makes me different? One of the things I realized, it's one of the greatest words in the big book, is the word creator. And at first I thought it was a mistake, because here I was, the atheist. And in fact, the Supreme Court of the United States, because of that and other reasons, has deemed that for the purposes of the federal prison system, AA is a religion. That's why, but no judge can order someone to come to AA. They can give them several options, and if they pick that option, then it's been their own choice for doing it. But if you look at the decision, it's a very interesting decision. It's actually on WeJoy, if you look at the readings. It's an interesting decision. But what that creator word means for me is, I didn't create me. I didn't pick my parents. You know, I've heard people say, proud to be an American. I go, you know, what did I do? You know, I was out. I'm very grateful to be an American. I'm very grateful to have had the parents I had. My Sandy Beach, one of my favorite speakers, in 2009 did a talk on whenever we are disturbed, there is something wrong with us. And my mom was dying of cancer at that time. And I began to realize that if I started grieving for my mom, I would become part of her problem. So I decided not to plan my grief. And as her body was going down and the things she couldn't work around the house and the spiritual was just shining out because she was born again, she had no doubt where she was going. You know, I just said, don't hurry, you know, shuffling off this mortal coil. You know, we'd like to keep you around. But I got to just be there with her. And because I had all this caregiving experience, and when I got back in 2004, I started doing it again one day a week. And in fact, this week, I've taken care of a man who's 90 years old. Took him up to the Georgia National Cemetery and watched him put his hand on his wife's plaque there where her remains are. And sit there with the blue sky above him and the clouds above him. And I just got to sit back, close my eyes, and listen to him pray. Drink or do that. You know? So I had these skills, and so I was able to do things for my mom that my mom did for me when I was growing up. And when she passed away, we had the viewing, and I had my guitar there. My mom always liked for me to play guitar. So I had it right there in the viewing room, and there was this vehicle my mom rode around in this open casket. And this lady from a church comes in, and this 3 or 4 year old girl is clinging to her. You can't have fun at a funeral, right? And so I had my guitar, and I said, "Can I sing you a song?" And the little girl went, "Oh." And the mom went, "Yeah." So I sang "Marvelous Little Toy," you know. And then "Baby Beluga in the Deep Blue Sea," you know. And then she gets down on the floor right there in the room with coffee, you know. 5'2", eyes of blue. And she just said, "Don't mess with my blue suede shoes," you know. When she left, the little girl gave me a high five when she left, and she was smiling. My mom's basic nature was that of being a service. That's always the way she was. That is what she would have wanted me to be doing. And I never in my wildest dreams would have been able to plan that when she was dying of cancer. I would have never been able to anticipate that. I'll tell you this, though, I did the hardest gig I ever did the next day. I played at her funeral. Fortunately, other people knew the words. How great thou art. I come to the garden alone. You know? And that day, it was just, I got to be with my dad the last few days. He lasted two more years, 2012. And I got to make an amends to him. I'd gotten $2,000 worth of furniture and told him I'd pay him back, but it just kept going and going. And this was back when we first got married. And I said, well, Dad, I still owe you that $2,000. He said, no, don't worry, you paid it back. I was there with him 72 hours. And on the last day, I just said, because he had not really been alive, since Mom died. He hadn't really been putting an effort into life. And I just said, Dad, I got a question for you. He said, what's that? I said, do you want to live or do you want to die? I said, it's okay. I think a man has a right to decide, that question. And he kind of hemmed up. He looked at me and says, I want to live. I said, well, you might want to start acting like it. And I got to be with him. Now, that was Friday. At 3:45 in the morning, I was sleeping in the little recliner thing. And I looked up as the nurse came in, because I just woke up with it. And I could tell he was dead. Because I'd had the nursing, I'd had that experience, and I was okay. Everything had been set. You guys had taught me to clean it up, to change the story, to become a different person. The nurse, she saw me in there, they were resuscitating, even though I wasn't a do not resuscitate, but the head nurse, the regular one, wasn't on the floor. So the lady who had discovered him, she said, oh, you can't be in here. So she moves me outside from the door, and I'm looking in at it. Oh, no, you can't be out here. And she goes, how are you doing? And I went, I'm fine. How are you doing? And she went, he was one of the special ones. And I said, and he really loved what you were doing. He thought a lot about what you were doing. See, I knew from being a caregiver that you get that. I've had a lady die on my watch before. I know what that does to a caregiver. You begin to feel, what could I have done extra? What could I have done? And I was able to give comfort at that time. You guys taught me how to do that. I learned that from listening to all these stories. You know, so much of this program is learning how to respond appropriately. Isn't it? And how do I learn that? By hearing your stories. This is an oral society, folks. It's not a set of instructions. You know, Jesus taught in parables for a reason. We learn by the stories. Share your story. I love what Father Joseph Martin said. The best advice I can give you is don't give any advice. And that's been great. My daughter will call me up, Daddy, I know you don't give any advice. But I said, well, we don't talk about problems either. I got rid of all my problems just like that. You ready? Would you like to get rid of all your problems just like that? I'm serious. Rename them situations. They're gone in the flash of a name. So what's the situation? So she'll tell me the situation, and I'll be able to go, well, I've never had that situation before or anything like it, but I know somebody who has. Or I've been in similar situations, and when I did this, this is what happened. I don't know if it applies to you or not. Those are the things, the learning how to recite. You heard what I was like when I came in here. All the stuff you're hearing is things that I hope are flowing through me and back from this program. It's almost like I've got recirculation in my car with the air conditioning, And it's like I'm hearing it and I get to practice in my life and I get to recirculate it out as my own experience. How did I take what your experience, how did it filter through me, and then what I did became a whole unique new experience? I've probably talked longer than you guys were expecting. But I want to finish up with the third step prayer as Bill changed it. In 1967, on page 210 of As Bill Sees It, Bill changed a word in there. It says, God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that my transcendence over them. Not victory. Victory is standing in the stadium holding up the trophy saying, we won. What happens tomorrow? Back to fighting again. And it doesn't go along with what you guys read, 84 to 85. We cease fighting everything. And when the first time I read that, I said, that's off. That doesn't connect, because I'm a concept guy. I see concepts. It's just a gift. I'm tall, too, by the way. You know, I'm both gift. I don't know. But I saw it, and Bill changed it. He changed another thing in there. He's changed a couple of things in there. They're interesting changes. But transcendence is like going from being a bottom feeder, swimming to the surface, growing wings, and flying. It's metamorphosis. It's a complete psychic change. Take away my difficulties that my transcendence over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Thank you very much for having me.